brand new series of Inside Education, the podcast for educators who are interested in teaching.
And that's right. For those of you who are regular listeners, you'll notice that I have not mentioned the connection with the radio program. And that's because despite 10 very happy years producing Inside Education on 103.2 Dublin City FM, I have decided this year to decouple the podcast from the radio station. And the main reason for that is that the constraints of a 28-minute radio program make producing the podcast much more challenging. For example, the program needs to be exactly 28 minutes, and sometimes I ended up leaving out really good material from guests in order to fit it into 28 minutes. Sometimes I'd end up having to split a guest's interview over 2 weeks, and then sometimes it was difficult to make up the exact 28 minutes. So by having a freestanding podcast, I hope that it will give more flexibility to the program, that I'll be able to bring you more guests during the year, and the program will be longer. It will vary a little bit from week to week, but I imagine somewhere between 40 to 50 minutes, maybe up to an hour on occasion. And I certainly am looking forward to experimenting with the podcast format in the coming weeks and months. It also means that there's a new email address for the program. So the podcast address is seandelaney.insideeducation@gmail.com. The usual Twitter handle still applies, at InsideEd, that's at InsideEd. And remember, there's still an archive of close to 400 great podcasts available at seandelaney.com/podcasts. Because I'm moving on to a podcast now, I'd be really grateful if you would take the time to rate the podcast and give it a comment wherever you listen to podcasts, be that on iTunes, Spotify, Overcast, Stitcher, and so on. So now we come on to this week's programme. And this week the guest is an expert on leadership in education who last appeared on Inside Education in 2011. And I'm delighted to welcome him back again. Andy Hargreaves is research professor at Boston College, visiting professor at the University of Ottawa, distinguished visiting professor at Hong Kong University, professor at the University of Stavanger in Norway, and honorary professor at Swansea University. He is past president of the International Congress for School Effectiveness and Improvement, an advisor in education to the First Minister of Scotland, and from 2016 to 2018 to the Premier of Ontario. Andy is a founder of the Atlantic Rim Collaboratory, ARC, a group of 9 nations committed to broadly defined excellence, equity, well-being, inclusion, democracy, and human rights. Andy has written more than 30 books, which have attracted multiple outstanding writing awards. He is ranked in the top 20 scholars with most influence on education policy in the United States. In 2015, Boston College gave him its Excellence in Teaching with Technology Award. He holds honorary doctorates from the Education University of Hong Kong and the University of Uppsala in Sweden. His most recent book, with Michael O'Connor, is called Collaborative Professionalism When Teaching Together Means Learning for All. It was published by Corwin in May 2018. Professor Hargreaves was invited to give the opening keynote address at the focal meeting of the World Education Research Association meeting, which was held in Tokyo in August 2019. Closer to home, he will be a keynote speaker at FAILTA in Galway this weekend. I met with Andy after his Tokyo talk, and I asked him what his message was for those who attended the talk.
What I was really trying to address in this conference about equity and democracy was the international crises that we have in just about everything, which we see all across the world, Brexit, Trump, yellow vests, extinction disruptors, beatings on the Hong Kong subway. What is this all about, and what sense can we make of it? And what I tried to share with the audience is that a lot of this is actually caused by economic inequality, widening economic inequality, less and less social mobility, an opportunity for people to move up. But it plays out in issues of identity, feeling threatened by people who are different from us, who might take away the scarce things that we have, outsiders, foreigners, people with pensions when we don't, and so on. And so I really then began to look at what were some of the causes of this, and how were at least some governments responding that seemed to be trying to respond in a more positive way. Examples will be places like Scotland, for instance, and I particularly focused on Ontario, which has had a fourfold priority until this last year when the government changed to a populist government, has had a fourfold priority for broad excellence, so not just literacy, maths and science, for equity understood as inclusion, so that it's more possible for children to succeed if they see themselves in a way in the school and its curriculum. Well-being, so being safe, cared for, having a sense of belonging, good health, quality of life, and doing all this while maintaining public confidence. And then I went on to talk about how that looked on the ground in the schools in Ontario in 10 of the 72 school districts that we studied, and what the positives were, and there are many, and where some of the challenges still remain, and what we can learn from that for the rest of us, particularly in terms of the nature of teacher collaboration, and how teacher collaboration can be developed in a way that supports these inclusive ends, with a diversity of students in your class, with the goal of creating greater senses of acknowledgement, respect, interconnection, and senses of belonging and commitment to something bigger than themselves.
So that's a fantastic summary of what was a very detailed and provocative talk, I think. And there's so many things I'd like to unpack, but one of the things that you said, and a number of times you repeated the phrase, the world is off its axis.
Yes.
But one of the divisions you made is that up until 2015, and you put a start on this as well, you said roughly 2000 to 2015,
yeah,
there was a concern with achievement and effort.
Yeah.
And since then, it's more about identity, engagement and well-being. And one question I wanted to ask you is, was it just 2000 to 2015 that we were concerned with achievement and effort, or has that always been the case with modern education?
Well, of course, there's nothing wrong with achievement and effort. You know, I'm probably sitting here with you now because of a lot of achievements and a very great deal of effort that continues. So we shouldn't disrespect these as core values, the need for achievement, deferred gratification, making your work your best effort, not your first effort. I think these are things that many teachers have always valued in their students. But I think there was a period from, really one of the first countries was England in the late 1980s, a little bit later in places like the United States, other parts of Europe, Australia, and so on, to really drive the system with an overwhelming focus on achievement and effort, not just for the benefit of individual students and their opportunities, but also as a way of demonstrating accountability and politicians being able to show the public that education was a priority, and that they were making improvements as shown by measurable gains. And so measurable gains became not any achievement, but really quite narrow achievement, largely literacy and numeracy, in measurable forms. So the whole system in lots of places became driven by the quest to raise measured achievement results. And that led to all kinds of negative consequences, neglect of the whole child, of a broader curriculum, of children's emotional development as well as their cognitive development, and a lot of negative consequences for the teaching force as well, who felt teachers come into teaching because they want to teach and make a difference with their kids, and when they feel their work is unduly narrowed down to a fraction of what they feel that they're about, then they start to lose heart and not want to come into the job and not want to stay in the job over time.
Are you thinking in particular of the pressure that the likes of TIMSS and PISA and PIRLS have put on schools internationally?
Not so much TIMSS and PIRLS, actually. TIMSS and PIRLS are ways of measuring the international performance of schools. I know quite a bit about Tims and Pearls. I've spent 15 years at Boston College. This is really where they're administered from. They're quite low-key. There's no big fanfare about them. I think countries and systems use them to check up on how they're doing and to see how they can improve over time. But PISA is a different kind of beast. And PISA has developed a lot of fanfare, a lot of publicity, and a lot of competition between nations about where they will be on PISA. I well remember going to on an OECD review of Wales in about 2013 as part of a team of four to look at the Welsh national education system. And at that time, they had what we fed back to them was this preposterous goal of wanting within about 3 years to be in the, I forget where it was, like the top 20 or something on PISA. And it turned out they just wanted to be higher than England. But that was a whole national priority. And we said, well, how will you do this? And they said, well, what we'll do is we'll buy packages of PISA items and PISA lessons, and we'll give our 15-year-olds and 13-year-olds practice in these, because these are the skills that PISA tests. So by the time they take the test, they'll know the skills, and our results will go up. And we fed back and we said, but, well, this is interesting, but impossible. And what is astonishing here is you say nothing about now you really have devolution from England. You say nothing about what it means to be Welsh, what it means to be educated as a Welsh person, what your vision is for your country, for your system, and so on. And we fed this back in a fairly direct way. And I have to say that the Welsh education system has responded utterly magnificently with a whole rethink of where it's moving in education, having schools and local authorities work together, focusing on learning and not so much on measured achievement and so on. It's just one small example, but all over the world, countries and national education systems have been driving their teachers relentlessly to ridiculous ends, simply to increase their ranking on PISA. And of course, what happens every year is that PISA introduces new countries, and so you go down in the rankings, but actually you're performing just the same as you were before. They just put people in ahead of you. But everybody says we've fallen four places and we need to get back. And I think in fairness now we're starting to see an end of that. PISA's still there, people still think about it, but the OECD, which is very influential, is now putting a lot of its attention to global competencies, which are a much broader range of skills and learning. They are now focusing also on well-being. So 2017 was their first report on comparing countries on quality of life indicators. And of course, the UN Sustainable Development Goals have become quite influential in helping countries think about where they move their educational systems. So I think national discourses are changing. I think global discourses are changing, and there's still many people very affected by achievement and effort, and that's the way they want to go. But the question is not now should we think about identity and belonging and so on. The question now is how do we think about these issues, and this is what many countries are wrestling with.
And this change has happened, say, over the last 4 or 5 years. And where has that come from?
The short answer is we really don't know. You could probably do like high-level discussions and so on. But when any change comes, usually what happens are three things. The internal solutions get exhausted. And so just as in a country, you can keep on pushing and pushing up achievement levels, but eventually you find you're putting 90% of your effort into getting like 0.5% gain or something of that kind. So all change comes when existing efforts and strategies become exhausted and aren't pushing you any further. And you need to change the game rather than try and scratch out tiny incremental further advancements on the game that you're playing. People start to sense that something's amiss. So I think globally, the backlash against testing has come not when professionals have challenged it, because nobody really listens to professionals. But it's come because of two things. It's come because when middle-class parents start complaining that this has spread beyond low-performing schools to all kinds of schools. So in England, for example, they started talking about coasting schools as well as absolute bog-standard sink schools. So coasting schools are schools where they're doing okay, but people say they could do a lot better given the kids that they've got. So suddenly now articulate middle-class parents started to discover that their children were unhappy, not enjoying school. Spending a lot of their time being anxious, preparing for tests. We've seen this in Ontario as well as around other parts of the world. I think it's been easier because of the attention to mental health, for people to talk about mental health issues in themselves and in their children, to talk about anxiety and things of that kind. So that has brought it up to the surface. There's been problems of teacher recruitment and retention in many countries, even in Scandinavia, in Australia, in the UK, in the US, because this is an environment that doesn't really draw teachers in who have a passion of making a difference in children's lives. And of course, these bigger questions have presented themselves irresistibly on a big political stage. What do we do about refugees and immigrants? How does this affect our curriculum and the sense of community in our schools? How do we respond to the spates of violence in school shootings and other shootings in North America? What about the anxiety that adolescent girls have because of Facebook and Instagram and the internet? And so there are a whole new set of problems in the world, really, that the public and politicians are facing. And the answer usually comes to schools, always. And so the kinds of agendas that schools are now facing really come from a mix of these different factors.
And I want to go into some of those factors in a little bit more detail in a moment. But First, I can see teachers saying, well, yeah, look, we're really good and we're really comfortable in the areas of effort and achievement. But in the areas of identity, engagement and well-being, I'm not so sure we're that well equipped or we're that well prepared to deal with that area. How would you respond to that possible response from teachers?
I disagree with that, actually. I think that the names can frighten people and the vocabulary can scare people. So we have to be careful about how we present this. Certainly all the Irish teachers I've ever met, primary teachers, secondary teachers, somewhat different from primary teachers, not completely, but somewhat different. But certainly primary school teachers want to care for the child, want to care for the whole child. They're interested in the whole of the child's development. They want to find out what the children's interests are and enable them to engage with those interests. That's a simple question of identity, and it's just that if you have more diverse children in front of you, then you have a greater diversity of interests and a bit more of a challenge about how to identify with other children's interests. Identity is in the Irish curriculum from the age of five. So from the age of five, Irish children are helped to think about what is their identity, how do they develop this. This comes, of course, partly from Catholic history and Catholic faith. And now because more and more children in Irish schools will not be from historic Irish heritage, teachers will need to think a bit more about what that looks like for children from other backgrounds, other faiths, no faith and so on as well. So I disagree. I think primary teachers have always been interested in, and the joy of teaching is connecting with the whole of the child and seeing the growth and the progression and the breakthrough and the light bulbs going on with those children too.
There was one sentence you said yesterday, and I think it was yourself, I don't think you were quoting someone, you said, identity is more important than achievement. Right. Is that really the case for teachers, that identity is more important than achievement?
When I heard this is something that really made me think, because we were When we first heard it, we were in the age of achievement and effort, and then we went to what in Canada is called a Franco-Ontarian community. So Franco-Ontarians are French-speaking, French culture families in Ontario who are a minority, so they're not from Quebec, where the dominant culture is French-speaking and French language. They don't reproduce themselves very quickly, so they're a shrinking population. They face many challenges, having ministry documents and curriculum translated into French, for example, is quite expensive and not always done as well as it should. They feel they are different culturally. As one teacher put it to me once, she said, our children are different. They talk a lot, they skip and they jump, even when they're 13 and 14. It is a different kind of culture. And for them, this identity is under threat, as it is with many minorities. And so for them, who you are and what you become is at least as important and sometimes more important than how high you achieve. And I probably wouldn't want to put it that bluntly, but it certainly made me think that for many communities, not just that community, who you are and what you become is surely as important as what your math scores are or your examination results or anything of that kind.
You also spent a bit of time talking about the issue of conflicting identities. So somebody may be gay and Catholic, or they may be black and female. What is the response that teachers should have to those kind of matters in identity?
Yeah, and I think there are three ways to think about this. And the third is a bit of a struggle, to be honest. The first area is to make every child and their on all the aspects of their identity welcome in the school. So you may be a refugee, you may be a girl, you may have a learning disability. All these are important parts of your identity. So a curriculum that values things that appeal to girls as well as boys, and vice versa, in literature or in science, for example, is very important. Something we've seen a lot in Ontario is if you have a disability, in a way owning that disability, learning about famous, accomplished people who have your disability, which we're seeing, and self-advocating with your teachers for how they should respond to your disability in terms of distractibility, for example. That's important. And having a school and a teacher who knows how to welcome and engage with refugees from different cultures and the assets that they bring, as well as the deficits. So the first is, it's a cliche, is acknowledging, respecting, honouring, and giving a sense of inclusion to all the cultures and identities that come into your school, not just from different foods or festivals or music, but in a deep way through the curriculum and every aspect of it. And that's quite challenging, but that's probably the easiest part. The second part is to understand that sometimes when your children struggle with their learning, there are many things behind that struggle other than not being able to master a concept. So in secondary school, for example, I struggled a lot with maths when I was around 14. And the reason for that was I went too hard in my maths lessons. And the reason for that was I was looking after my mum. And the reason for that was that my dad had died. My mum was depressed, couldn't get out of bed, couldn't get out of the house. And my brothers were in factories. So like many kids from poor families, suddenly they find they're raising their parents or their sisters or their brothers instead of their parents raising them. And so when a child has a learning problem, you know, part of the answer is, you know, more time, more practice, more effort. But some of it also is, what are all the other things going on in their lives in terms of things like poverty or just arriving in the country or having experienced post-traumatic stress or being a child of colour and feeling prejudice and discrimination, and attending to all these things so that they have opportunities for success, and seeing that these don't usually come singly. They come multiply, and you're not the hero individually who should understand all of these and respond to them, but you need to bring a community of adults together in the school who can respond to these multiple issues, these intersections of problems together. That's also challenging, but we know what the strategies are for dealing with that by bringing those adults together. And the third one is much more difficult, and I think this is a political question in the society as well as an educational question in the school, and that is to understand that few identities are perfect or flawless. Most of us are flawed as human beings. It's a basic understanding of the Catholic faith, actually. So understanding that to begin with. And most identities are flawed. There are no perfect romantic identities and few deeply sinful and wicked ones. So understanding that white working class communities that are economically marginalized are sometimes xenophobic and prejudiced is something to acknowledge. But because they're sometimes xenophobic and prejudiced is not a reason to acknowledge their poverty and marginalization and disadvantage. They go together. Some faith groups, including Catholicism, have difficulty, at least officially, with LGBTQ issues. On the ground, I think things are under the radar, things are getting much better and much more positive. But acknowledging that there's progress in many faiths to be made in that area is incredibly important. I could go through a whole list of groups and, you know, where these conflicting issues are, but I think first we have to be honest about this as a society.
Yeah, and I think that's not acknowledged, the imperfections in particular identities, in all identities.
Yeah, we all have room to grow, and we need somehow to create a space where we can come together, and not easy, to talk about these things and move them forward and somehow say, as a society, these are our values. These are our values as a society, and we welcome and embrace diversity, but our job is to help every culture and every community move towards embracing, acknowledging and supporting these particular sets of values and the people who represent them.
On the topic of well-being, you talked about anxiety, hopelessness, narcissism among young people. Can you say a little bit more about those kind of matters and how they're impacting on well-being?
It's hard to know where some of these things come from. We have some clues. One of them is economic inequality and lack of social mobility. The data is very clear, which is I came from a poor, you know, poor background in a working class community. I worked hard and had lots of creative ways of getting around the system when I needed to. But behind me, I also had public libraries, public housing, the public health service, the National Health Service, and public education, and free university, all of these things. So my American friends always like to tell me I'm the complete embodiment of the American dream. And I say, well, that's very kind of you, but actually behind me are all these other things. And these other things aren't behind people so much now as they used to be. And mobility has shrunk. And I think young people intuitively start to see this when they can't get out of their parents' home when they're in their 30s. They can't get a start on the housing ladder. They see other people taking jobs because they've been able to do internships or put other things on their vita, and they've not been able to do that. So I think there's a big issue with lack of opportunity and lack of mobility that gives a sense of hopelessness. I think our ideas of what it means to be successful have become skewed and distorted. Success means being an instant millionaire with a fabulous startup as a millennial and before you're 30. Being successful means being a reality TV star and being
an influencer on Instagram.
Having a sense of fame. Having a lot of followers. So, you know, a lot of people, when I meet kids, the thing kids are most impressed with is that I have 35,000 followers on Twitter. Now, many of them may be dead. I definitely haven't bought any followers. But of all the things about me, it is the one that they're most interested in. So I think we have some distorted senses of what it means to be successful. And I think if we reinvest in public life, and not just in private life, and one of those is teaching. And the idea behind jobs and employment, not just being success and monetary value, but really having a sense of fulfillment, and education being about having a sense of fulfillment and meaning and purpose in life and career, then I think we can begin to deal with some of those senses of hopelessness. And the public sector is a great avenue for social mobility. When you cut back on the public sector, you cut back on people's opportunities for mobility. And that is something governments really need to understand. And the third, of course, which I sort of touched on, is technology and the internet. So the research is pretty compelling now across a range of studies. The best person is a professor called Gene Twenge. And that is that since the sort of mass diffusion of smartphones, adolescents, and particularly adolescent girls, are physically safer. They're less prone to violence, to drugs, to alcohol, to early pregnancy. Much less prone to those things, but much more prone to anxiety, depression, self-harming, suicidal thoughts, mainly because they're not going out. They're lying on their beds till 2 o'clock in the morning, getting no sleep, digitally enhancing images of themselves and wondering how perfect they look compared to everybody else, dealing with mean messages from other people about their postings or lack of postings and so on. So the answer to this for some schools is to ban mobile phones in schools, which I think is a ridiculous solution. If the teaching's awful, there's no point banning technology. You're still condemned to awful teaching. The point is to draw young people in with other things that are more intriguing and attracting than posting on Instagram and all the other things that they do. More outdoor education, more sense of adventure, more work in the community, more connection to the environment, more senses of belonging face to face and not just online. These are some of our big priorities, I think, now.
One of your recent articles was titled provocatively, "What's Wrong with Wellbeing?" And what is wrong with wellbeing in that sense?
Well, it seems strange to ask what's wrong with well-being, but I love well-being, and my wife loves me most of the time. But to love me properly, she also has to understand my flaws, of which I have a few. So to really love something, you have to engage with and acknowledge its flaws. And in a way, as a result, you can love it even more because you're dealing with the honesty of what you have in front of you. If you ignore the flaws, if you idealize it, then you suffocate it. So I think we should ask what's wrong with anything, actually. We should ask what's wrong with well-being, what's wrong with growth mindsets. And when I ask that question, people say, well, what could possibly be wrong with growth mindsets? What's wrong with God? And, of course, Catholic theologians ask this question all the time. You know, could God be a bit vain? Does God want a bit too much praise? So all these questions, so that we can love them more, I think, are questions that we have to ask. And from our research, so this is just empirical, but there's literature to back it up, we really ask three kinds of questions about what's wrong with well-being. One is that well-being is often seen as the individual answer to huge systemic problems. So you may have more poverty, you may have more disadvantage, you may not be investing in mental health support in the community. But you can have programs in schools of sort of mindfulness or emotional regulation for teachers as well as for children. And if you do that, then you've got a psychological answer rather than a sociological answer, basically. And I don't think it's either or. I think it's both and. But if you put all the weight on the well-being, it really expects it to do too much. I think you can't really have, secondly, you can't really have, or shouldn't really have, schools that are developing well-being in one part of what they do, while they're still actively creating ill-being in another part of what they do. And the example we see is testing and examinations, which create a lot of anxiety, a lot of ill-being, a lot of unhappiness. So schools have to think about ways to remove the ill-being for which they're responsible, as well as developing new forms of well-being to enhance their children's emotional, cognitive, social, physical, and spiritual growth. And there's a third problem with well-being, what we see from our data is in helping children to be well, we may be having culturally very specific ways or ideas of being well. When you look at international indicators of wellness, the countries that do badly are in Southeast Asia. So if you look at high achievement, poor quality of life, they're all in Southeast Asia. So the first conclusion we leap to is, well, that's where they have all this testing. So no wonder they don't feel well. And there's something in that. But at the same time, when I feed this back to my colleagues from Singapore, Hong Kong, Japan, where we are now, and various other places, they say, well, we just have a different understanding of what quality of life means. Quality of life does not mean happiness. Happiness is not an important value for us. Fulfillment is an important value for us. Duty to your parents, respect for your elders, loyalty to the group, attention to your family, rewards in the future by sacrificing things now. These are the sorts of things we regard as fulfilling, and happiness is a peculiar Western obsession. And so in the schools we see that actually calmness is sometimes the priority that teachers and the programs they use have of what it means to be well. But calm is not the only way to be well. Exuberance, happiness, physical engagement. These are other ways to be well. So when you want your children to be calm, just think, is it good for all the kids now? Or is it just good for you because you're the teacher and having calm kids is a lot easier to have a class of calm kids than a class of kids who are going wild with excitement about something.
As an aside before we continue, some people will be cross if I don't ask you, what's wrong with growth mindset?
Well, we've asked this to the educators we work with in Ontario, and they were shocked when they asked them. And we said, well, you know, just get into small groups and talk about this for a few minutes. And then suddenly there are all kinds of things wrong with growth mindsets. But the biggest one is if you say that these kids aren't succeeding and the problem is it's their growth mindset or your growth mindset, it means you don't have to deal with poverty. You don't have to deal with lack of attention to disadvantage or prejudice or all the other things that children suffer from. It's just your mindset. You need to fix your mindset. And so there are others, but that's just one. And everything has something that is wrong with it. And what we found with our educators was once they got that out, it didn't mean they didn't support growth mindsets anymore, but it meant that they supported it in a much more realistic way.
Yeah, I know, that makes sense. Your solution to a lot of these problems, Andy, is the area of collaborative professionalism, and you've written a book on this. Can you say a little bit about how that can help this transition, if you like, in education?
So I've been researching a teacher collaboration for 30 years now, and a rough tour through what we've learned over those 30 years would be teachers used to, some still do, mainly teach by themselves, one class, one teacher all day, particularly in primary school. And then evidence began to surface that in the early 1990s that those teachers just did less well than teachers who actually collaborated with other teachers, planned with other teachers, taught with other teachers, various other ways of working with them. So I'd say from about 25 years ago, we learned that on average, it's better to collaborate than not collaborate. It's good for the kids. It's better for teacher motivation. It keeps teachers more engaged. It's better for implementing change because you have more people committed to the change. And you're more likely to know the whole child rather than the bit of the child that you see. Everybody sees different bits of the child. So we began to get a sense that collaboration was a good idea. And then in came a thing called professional learning communities, which spread around the world as a particular way for teachers to collaborate, and many people found that quite artificial, quite contrived, quite constraining. And in many countries, professional learning communities were liked by administrators, but not liked by teachers. And so by the time we came to the book Collaborative Professionalism, I got some research funding to examine. Really, so if collaboration's mainly a good thing, but not always, What are some ways to deliberately design a collaboration, and what can we learn from them over time? There are many different designs, peer review, looking at examples of student work, networks between schools, collaborative planning, collaborative inquiry, learning walks, lesson study. I mean, we couldn't study all of them, but we took five. And I'd say we learned a couple of things from this that were important. Five examples in five countries. One is when people collaborate, they tend to divide into two ways of doing it. One thinks it's all about trust and it's all about relationships. And if you can just build trust and relationships and get people together in a group, you can solve everything. And the other group likes procedures and protocols as to how to go about working together. So lesson study has lots of these in terms of how to give feedback in a respectful way without hurting or injuring or insulting people, or on the other hand, avoiding the problem. And what we learned is both of these things are important, and that the point of a good protocol is not to avoid trust and relationships, but it's to deepen the relationships. Good friends don't always make good collaborators, because good friends often avoid the difficult questions. And so you need the protocols to push the interaction a bit more deeply. That's the first thing we learned. Secondly, is we found that sometimes people think collaboration's a luxury if you've got the time or the money on top of everything else. Perhaps if you're in an affluent school or in a private school, or you're well staffed. But we found that it's when you're in some of the hardest to serve communities that collaboration is most important. In rural communities with rural poverty, sometimes you're the only teacher in your school or the only teacher with your year level, and you have nobody else to talk to about the work. So finding a way to help rural teachers collaborate, and you have many in Ireland, to help them without vast expense of bringing them together physically all the time. Finding ways to do that online as well as face-to-face with protocols and not just rambling conversation. That this can make teachers feel less isolated, make them feel they have more strategies available, make them feel they have that moral support and relationships that can help them help their students succeed.
And having students succeed is what it's all about. That was Professor Andy Hargreaves, who gave the opening keynote address at the 2019 focal meeting of the World Educational Research Association. That brings this week's programme to an end. To listen back to this programme or any of the hundreds of previous episodes of Inside Education, please go to seandelaney.com and click on the podcast tab. My book about teaching, Become the Primary Teacher Everyone Wants to Have, is available from online bookstores and many local libraries. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney saying goodbye. Thank you for listening.